I'm going to speak to you today on the subject of courage. Courage is the ability to face very crucial moments in our lives with boldness and fortitude. Paul told the Corinthians to be on guard, to stand firm in the faith, be men of courage, be strong. So you have to be ready, because you never know when something very important is going to happen, like David when he actually fought Goliath. He was on a mission to deliver cheese to his brothers. And there was this enormous challenge. And we know the story of David is one of the most famous stories, David fighting Goliath, one of the most famous stories of the Bible. But most moments of courage are not like that. They're not performed in front of thousands of people. They're done in total obscurity. In fact, they are doing things that nobody even knows about except God. He's the one who actually sees it. I take care of my own lawn, and usually we have a lot of trees and a lot of shrubs, and to do all of that almost seems a little overwhelming sometimes. By the time I get through mowing the lawn, I'm ready to quit. But I developed this little system a few years ago that I would just do two or three extra things, maybe trim two or three limbs or work on a few bushes. Instead of doing everything, I tended to just put it off. But I can do a little bit. If you apply that principle to life, we oftentimes will overlook something in our own life. We'll say, well, I need to do that. I need to be a little bit more diligent. I need to a little bit more persistent in this area. I'll work on that someday. The problem is someday never comes to us. Courage is the willingness and the persistence to work on the things in our own lives that we've been putting off. That's a big part of courage. And we first start by acknowledging I have something in my own life I need to work on and stop blaming anybody else for it, because that is the first excuse. Yeah, I got something wrong, but it's his fault, it's her fault, my parents' fault, school fault, the mayor of Arnold's fault, the governor, the president. Everybody but the real person responsible. Do you remember the guy who used to have a radio show called The Rest of the Story? Paul Harvey, he made his whole reputation off of using that line, The Rest of the Story. So he was going to tell us oftentimes about something we heard, but a part that we never had heard. He was going to tell us the rest of the story. And I was always interested to hear Harvey's rest of the story. When we get to heaven, we're actually going to hear the rest of the story about many things that we had no idea. People who have lived their lives in total obscurity, died in obscurity, will be very famous in heaven. And their lives will be brought to front and center for all of us. For instance, when we, in our many years in Argentina, there was a missionary there. Her name was Pansy Blossom. That's no joke. That was her actual name. A single lady who first started her career in China, did several years in China, and then in Peru did many years, and then over 50 years in Argentina. So we knew her very, very well. She was very kind to our family. And when she got to her retirement years, they couldn't make her stay away from Argentina. They wouldn't, once she reached a certain age, they wouldn't let her go back for 4 years, but they would let her go for 6 months. So she would always go, but she'd never buy a return ticket. And then everybody would make sure there was an offering and she'd go home and then she'd come back. She did that for many, many years. Eventually, her health weakened and she wound up in a rest home in Springfield, Missouri. And she was a light in that rest home, winning people to the Lord to her dying days. And then in July of 2003, she had her funeral. And at her funeral, there was only a dozen people attended that funeral. In heaven, you're going to find out about how many pastors all over Argentina, their churches actually came into existence or actually grew because of this enormous generosity of this lady, of the missionaries that went around the world from Argentina, how she helped them. And nobody will actually know the amount of money or sacrifice because she died penniless. Even when she was in the rest home, she sent all of her money to Argentina. And the rest of the story will be told us. She's a lady who will have no regrets of how she lived her life. I think living life and having no regrets at the end is perhaps the greatest goal for any of us, because I find many people wind up with regret at the end of their life. And they live with that regret in the last 10, 15, 20 years, some people more, because they see life is, there's just a short part of it left, and this regret is a very powerful force in their life. So I want to speak on the subject of one of the ways that we can live our lives and arrive to the end of not having any regret is to do what Jesus says, and that is to live with abandon. Jesus says, throw your life away for the cause of Christ, and at the end, you'll find your life. You'll find satisfaction. You'll find fulfillment. But pursue your life. Pursue your selfish goals, and let Christ be in the background, and at the end, you'll wind up with nothing. That's a paraphrased version of what Jesus said, and that's what we call living your life with abandon, abandoning everything but Christ. Dr. Lawrence White is a Methodist pastor from Houston. He's very articulate. You can listen to this guy spellbound. He has roots to the Lutheran Church in Germany. He speaks German. He and his sons are clergy. He pastors a large Lutheran church in the city of Houston, and he goes back and forth, and he knows the history of the Lutheran Church in Germany like no one that I'm aware of. He tells stories of the Lutheran Church and of the people in the aftermath of World War II that are very fascinating. This is a story that he related. It says, the saddest and most tragic feature of the Christian experience in Germany was the bitter expression of regret that came from so many afterwards, who realized their failure only too late. One such man was a university professor and a diplomat named Albert Haushofer. He was a quiet, gentle man who wrote poetry in his spare time. As gradually he came to recognize the enormity of the evil of Nazism, he was drawn into resistance and arrested in 1944. After the failure of the Stauffenberg plot to assassinate Hitler. In the final days of the war, as the Russian tanks moved through the outskirts of the city of Berlin, the dictator hid in his bunker like a rat trapped in his hole. The SS guards in the Moabit city prison were given a list of those who were not to be allowed to survive the downfall of Nazism because they knew too much. Albert's name was included on that death list. A group of seven prisoners were taken out of their cells that morning. They were told they were about to be released. Each of the prisoners was assigned an SS guard. They were led out of the jail into the nearby Tea Garden, the great park in the city of Berlin, in the center of Berlin. As they came to the middle of the park, out of sight from anyone else, each guard stepped up behind the prisoner assigned to him and shot him in the back of the head. The bodies were abandoned there in the snow and the mud of the ruined city. Sometime later, Albert's brother heard rumors of what had happened, and he hurried into the park to search for his brother's body. And when he found it, there clutched in his hand was a blood-stained sheet of paper. Written on that paper was a poem that Albert had composed just a few hours before his execution. It was entitled, "I Am Guilty." "The burden of my guilt," the condemned man wrote, "before the law weighs light on my shoulders. To plot and conspire was my duty to the people. I would have been a criminal had I not. I am guilty, although not in the way you think. I should have done my duty sooner. I was wrong. I should have called the evil more clearly by its name. I hesitated to condemn for far too long. I now accuse myself within my own heart. I have betrayed my conscience. For far too long, I have deceived myself and my fellow man. I knew the course of evil from its start. My warning was not loud enough or clear enough. Today, as I die, I know what I am guilty of." That is a powerful warning for those who desire to live your lives completely free of any regret. How we do that is to have the courage to simply do the right things in our life. I want to follow the life of Stephen. This is Stephen, who was found in the book of Acts, the first martyr of the church. But he exemplifies courage as much as anyone in the entire Bible. And for that reason, we're looking at him today, his commitment to Christ. He's unintimidated by those who stand against his faith and his commitment to Christ. But he never flinches. And he's the kind of man who can teach us how to live the Christian life with courage. Let's examine Stephen's life. First, the first factor I observe about Stephen is Stephen was transformed by the grace of God. We don't have all the facts of Stephen, family grew up in, or where his conversion to Christ happened, but we have enough to know that he understood grace as a gift, not as an earned gift. So Acts chapter 6, verse 8. Now Stephen, a man full of God's grace and power. Those are very powerful words. He's full of grace. This is the power of the gospel. This is what transforms people's lives, to be full of grace. Not all Christians are full of grace, let me tell you. If you've ever met a haughty Christian, if you've ever met an uncrying Christian, a rude Christian, they can be Christians. They can be on their, you know, they know God, but they're not full of grace. Stephen is a man full of grace and power, not his own power. This is the transforming power of the gospel. So much so, did great wonders and miraculous signs among the people. He is generously sharing. He's ministering to people. He's working. Then the next thing we find out about Stephen is that he is a problem solver. I actually think that the greatest platform for living our lives is, for Christ, is problems. Problems become the platform that we can exemplify our faith. A lot of times you'll find a young Christian will say, I'm just looking for a way to serve Christ. Well, all you have to do is just look for the problem that's around you and become a problem solver, and you found a wonderful platform. But many of us are actually run from problems. I don't do problems, okay? Let somebody else do problems. But problems are the way we can actually live out our faith. Problems in our own family, problems in our neighborhood, problems at work. The world's a broken place. The human race is a broken place, and problems are the essence of life. And when people are willing to take a problem, work through it and help solve the problem, you have exemplified what the Christian life is all about. So there is a problem in the early church. The early church is phenomenal. When you read the book of Acts, it's one of the most exciting books in the Bible to read because the first sermon is ever preached. They don't even have a building, but they have 3,000 people who form the congregation. The first sermon preached by Peter. A few days later, 5,000 more, so it's barely 2 weeks old, and they have a congregation of almost 10,000 people, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. So fast that problems are arising, and they aren't aware of it. So here's the first problem that is recorded. The apostles, this is the 12 disciples who we call apostles now, they have a problem, and they need some people to solve this problem. Acts 6:1. In those days, when the number of disciples was increasing, the Grecian Jews among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. So they had a program for taking care of the widows. But the Hebrew Jews widows were being well taken care of, and the Grecian, the ones from Greek descendancy, were being overlooked. And there were complaints being made. And evidently it's true. So they actually selected deacons and their name for us in the book of Acts, and Stephen is one of those first deacons, and their first assignment was, you figure this problem out, make that distribution fair and equitable, and they did. It's through problems like this, through Stephen's ministry, that Stephen is actually being prepared for something very great in his life. He doesn't know that. Most people who have faced great tests are completely unaware. If God showed us what was ahead, we would probably never even be able to comprehend what we will face. Stephen is going to be the first martyr of the church. He's going to face death for Christ. But it's through all of these problems and through daily living that Stephen is actually being prepared. It's through God's grace in his life. God is always preparing us for what's ahead if we're committed to him. And we are courageously facing step by step. There's a problem. There's a problem in my own life. There's a problem in my family. There's a problem in my work. And we're just working through it. God's preparing us for something greater. I ran across this years ago. George Matheson, a pastor in Scotland in the 1800s, late 1800s, 1900s, he preached in a sermon about courageous commitment. And in it is an excerpt of what it takes to be prepared for being a true servant of the Lord. Here is his words. "My soul, reject not the place of thy preparation. It has ever been the robing room for royalty. Ask the great ones of the past what has been the spot of their prosperity. They will say, it was the cold ground on which I once was laying. Ask Abraham. He will point you to the sacrifice of Moriah. Ask Joseph, he will direct you to his dungeon. Ask Moses, he will date his fortune from the danger in the Nile. Ask Ruth, she will bid you build her monument on the field of her toil. Ask David, he will tell you that his songs came from the night. Ask Job, he will remind you that God answered him out of the whirlwind. Ask Peter, he will extol his submission in the sea. Ask John, he will give you the psalm and Patmos. Ask Paul, and he will attribute his inspiration to the light that struck him blind. Ask one more, the Son of Man. Ask him whence has come his rule over the world. He will answer, from the cold ground on which I was lying, the Gethsemane ground. I received my scepter there. Thou too, my soul, shall be garlanded by Gethsemane. The cup thou faint would pass from thee will be thy coronet in the sweet by and by. The hour of thy loneliness will crown thee. The day of thy depression will regale thee. It is the desert that will break forth into singing. It is the trees of thy silent forest that will clasp their hands." It's hard to imagine that trials and difficulties have a purpose when we're going through them. For the person who can see no meaning or purpose in trials and difficulties, you will emerge having learned nothing. You will have suffered in vain. But if you can see the trial as something God is allowing you to go through, and in the trial, God has meaning for you, God has purpose, your life is committed to him, you will actually come out not only having learned something, but having been better prepared for what is ahead. That's what George Matheson was writing so eloquently about. Stephen is a man full of grace and full of power. I don't know how many years Stephen lived, but I think he's still a pretty young man. If you look at the scriptures, I don't think there are too many years that he's ministering, but he reached an age of fruition where two things came together in Stephen's life that rarely come for all of us. He became very knowledgeable in the faith. He was a studious person of scripture, and he came to really know the scriptures very, very well. And secondly, he became very articulate in defending the scriptures. We call that apologetics. You can't defend something that you don't know very well. Stephen becomes the first of the apologetics. There's a whole ministry of people who defend our faith very, very well. Some of you may have heard of Ravi Zacharias. He is probably one of the most famous apologetics that there is. And he defends our faith with an articulate voice that is very knowledgeable of the scriptures. So here's where the apologetic ministry of Stephen begins in verse number 9. Opposition, and that's the word there, opposition arose, however, from members of the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called, Jews of Cyrene and Alexandria, as well as the provinces of Cilicia and Asia. These men began to argue with Stephen. So he had always gone to the synagogue, and he was invited, as everyone was, to speak. And he had begun to share lectures, sermons, talks about Jesus. But as he continued to do that, there was opposition, and people began to protest and argue with him. But what happened was, anytime anyone would raise a point of opposition, Stephen was so knowledgeable in the scriptures, he could refute it. So much so that the other person would be left without an argument. But that didn't cause agreement. It only caused more opposition because they were defiant. Verse number 10 says, "But they could not stand up against his wisdom or the spirit by whom he spoke." So it's not hard to see that Stephen's ministry was controversial when you read that verse right there. A little background of what was actually happening in the synagogue and Stephen's talks. So for several thousands of years in the Jewish nation, they had done things the same way. The Jews had attempted to obtain forgiveness through the sacrifice of animals. Animals were literally killed, their blood was caught in containers, and that's all prescribed in the book of Leviticus. That's the way they attempted, and Stephen begins to tell them that's no longer necessary. You don't have to do that. You don't have to kill another goat. You don't have to kill another cow. You don't have to kill another lamb. You don't have to kill another bird. It is over. That was very difficult for them to actually accept. Stephen was actually saying the ultimate sacrifice was made. And Jesus had only been killed a few months before. So they all knew about Jesus. And Jesus says, Stephen says, Jesus is God's ultimate sacrifice. He replaces all of that. Stephen probably didn't write the book of Hebrews, but he could have, because everything that Stephen talks about is what the book of Hebrews is all about. Let's read Hebrews 9:14. "How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve the living God?" So when Stephen presents Christ as our high priest, his audience is very familiar with who a high priest is and the role of the high priest. When he talks about the temple, the tabernacle, they're all familiar with that. Let's review. The tabernacle is what the children of Israel had, the temple, Solomon's temple, and then later Herod's temple. They're all very similar. There is an outer court where sacrifices are made. All the animals are killed in the outer court. Then there is an inner court that's called the holy place, and that's where the priest burns incense and lights lamps, and where he prays for the people. Then there is one inner compartment past the holy place called the Holy of Holies, but it's a forbidden territory. Nobody can enter there. If you do, you die. The high priest is the only one who can ever go there, and he can only go once a year on the Day of Atonement, and only after he has done elaborate preparations for himself and for the people, and he enters in with the blood of a lamb that's going to atone for the sins of the people, but the next year he'll be back to do it again. He even has a rope tied to him in case something doesn't go right, they can pull him out, because nobody will be able to go in after him. It is to this that Stephen is addressing them. They are tied to this. This is the tradition. This is everything they know. They grew up with this. They practice it. And you have someone saying, you don't have to do that anymore. We don't even need this high priest. We don't need all these sacrifices. Do you know how hard it is for people to change their ways once they are determined? People don't even want to change the kind of soap they buy, or the toothpaste they buy, or the kind of car they drive, or people sit in the same seats. Yeah, make somebody mad, just look around and sit in their seat next Sunday and see. They'll come and stand for them. There'll be 50 other seats, and they'll be, because we are creatures of habit. And here Stephen is, he's telling them all these things that they're so attached to, they're obsolete. Listen to Hebrews 9:12. Jesus, that high priest, let's go back and review that. That high priest once a year, this is a big day. People are standing outside and they're on pins and needles as he goes into the Holy of Holies, and he has this blood, and he goes in there, and there is a mercy seat. It's the top of the Ark of the Covenant, which is inside there. And he puts that blood on what is the mercy seat, and that God grants forgiveness for the people. Now listen to this verse. He did not enter by means of the blood. That he stands for Jesus. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once and for all by his own blood, having attained eternal redemption. So Stephen says, he didn't come into the holy place in that temple. He went into the holy place in heaven before his Father. And he didn't go carrying blood of goats. He came in with his own blood. And the Heavenly Father received his blood and grants redemption. But the people were not receptive to his message. But do you think that made Stephen, well, yeah, people don't want to hear it. I'm not going to say it anymore. I don't want to offend anyone. Stephen wasn't contentious. He didn't go around starting arguments, but he wasn't going to back away from the truth because somebody didn't like it. That's where Stephen's courage came in. Verse 9 again, opposition arose. And it says the different places that these men were from. And it says, these men began to argue with Stephen. They believed that their land was sacred. They believed that the temple was sacred. They believed the law was sacred. But what Stephen was telling them, Moses was unsuccessful in taking away the sins of the people. The law was unsuccessful because they have continued to sin and rebel against God. Not until Jesus has come is there any possible way to receive salvation. And he won't have to die again. He died once. Stephen's faith enabled him to believe that the story of Jesus was worth telling. It had transformed his life. He was full of grace, and he was going to tell it to anybody, everywhere, and no amount of opposition would make this young man. And he didn't have the arrogance. His voice was filled with the grace of God. That's what's needed in Christians today, to be able to defend their faith, but with grace, minus arrogance, minus pride, just knowledgeable of the scriptures, articulate, but full of grace. Verse 11, this is what happens. Then they secretly persuaded some men to say, we have heard Stephen speak words of blasphemy against Moses and against God. Now, they're actually tampering with witnesses. You can go to jail for that. Okay, they're actually creating a false narrative. They didn't hear Stephen. Nobody did. He didn't blaspheme God. He didn't blaspheme Moses. But they are actually trying to create a circumstance whereby they can condemn him. So they stirred up the people and the elders and the teachers of the law. They seized Stephen and brought him before the Sanhedrin. That's the highest court, 70 members of the Sanhedrin in the Jewish land. They produced false witnesses who testified, this fellow never stopped speaking against this holy place and against the law. Remember, they said that about Jesus too. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs Moses handed down to us. Now, they never heard that. It's a total lie. But they have the people all stirred up. So they give Stephen a chance to make his defense. So if you ever read Acts chapter 7, it's like the longest chapter in the book. And you think, good gravy, what is this, Stephen? He makes no defense for himself. He's about to die, and he knows, I don't know if he knew they were going to kill him, but, I mean, you could see these people were mad enough that they probably would hurt you, and Stephen is aware of that. He makes no defense of himself. He reviews the history. He starts back at the beginning with Abraham, and he goes all the way through the history. As he gets to the end of his discourse, this is what he actually says to these 70 men, this high court called the Sanhedrin, beginning at verse number 51. You stiff-necked people. That's another way of saying you're stubborn. With uncircumcised hearts and ears, you are just like your fathers. You always resist the Holy Spirit. Was there ever a prophet your fathers did not persecute? They even killed those who predicted the coming of the righteous one. And now you have betrayed and murdered him. You who have received the law that was put into effect through angels, but have not obeyed it. Those words were Stephen's death warrant. He had to know that with saying those words, he was going to seal his death. That's an amazing amount of courage to be standing in front of a group of people and know good and well that if you say that, they're going to kill you. Stephen never flinched. That is courage on display. what is so striking about Stephen, there's no resentment, there's no bitterness, there's no hatred. In fact, look at his countenance in verse 15. Those are very, very tough words he says to them, but he doesn't have the face of someone who is bitter and filled with hate. It says in verse 15, all who were sitting in the Sanhedrin looked intently at Stephen, and they saw that his face was like the face of an angel. This is an enormous amount. I think it takes courage when someone has hurt you or someone has offended you or someone has insulted you to not feel hurt at that person and want to retaliate. Not only is he not, has no desire to retaliate, he speaks the truth of them, but the grace of God continues to show up, even in his countenance. What follows is this, verse 53, you who have received the law that was put into effect through angels, but have not obeyed it. When they heard this, they were furious and gnashed their teeth. So the opposite. He has this countenance that displays grace. They can't control themselves. We've heard of road rage where people pull out a gun, they pull out a baseball bat, they start beating the other car. They go to prison, and they're just mad because somebody cut them off from getting into the lane. And we're seeing this happen right here in 141 by Arnold. Somebody pulled out a gun and started shooting at another car a few months ago. This is the kind of explosive anger that has taken over this court. This is a prestigious court, and these men are acting like animals. They come at Stephen. They pull him out of the witness stand. When they heard this, they were furious and gnashed their teeth at him. But Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, looked up to heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. That's interesting because every picture we have in Scripture of Jesus, he's always seated at the right hand of God. But on this occasion, Stephen looks up and Jesus is standing because Jesus stood up for Stephen. That's quite a tribute. For the first martyr, Jesus stands up. They killed Stephen's body, but they couldn't kill his spirit. They hurled those stones to kill Stephen as his executioners were stoning Stephen with their projectiles because as they brought him out, threw him down a cliff, and then they each throw stones at him. He prayed for them. This is incredible. So this story is either utterly false and it's a fable, or it is the great example of courage that I am presenting it today. So as they are killing him, they hear Stephen praying a prayer. What kind of prayer do you think Stephen would be praying? Lord, bring down on their heads this sin that they are doing today. May their enemies stone them. May their houses be torn down. You can imagine anything he might want to say, but this is his prayer found in verse 59. While they were stoning him, while the stones are coming, Stephen prayed, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Then he fell on his knees and cried out, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. And when he had prayed that, he fell asleep. Does that have any similarity to Jesus' prayer on the cross? Where Jesus prayed to his Father, Father, do not hold this sin against them. They don't know what they're doing. That is incredible courage. What of Stephen's influence? Well, we'll probably hear the rest of the story when we get to heaven. But Acts chapter 7, verse 58 says this. They dragged him out of the city and began to stone him. Meanwhile, the witnesses laid their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. This is Saul, who becomes the Apostle Paul. His name is Saul. He is a murderer. He hates people like Stephen. He is extremely grateful, happy, excited that Stephen's being stoned. But he heard that prayer. He saw Stephen die. He would have seen his defense, the whole thing. The influence of Stephen on Paul doesn't say too much, but I think that we know it must have had a powerful effect on the Apostle Paul because it won't be very long till the Apostle Paul will be met with his blinding light on his road, on the road to Damascus, and he commits his life to Christ. And after a few years of preparation, becomes the apostle that takes the gospel to the Gentiles. If we want to be able to arrive at the end of our life and have no regret, then we have to be men and women like Stephen to have courage to live our lives. Not too many of us will be asked to live like this. Some of us might, as we look around the world and we see the animosity growing toward Christianity greater and greater. We don't know what tomorrow holds. But courage is needed just every day to deal, first of all, with all the problems that I make. I told the church Wednesday night a story that's very fascinating. The New York Times invited several famous authors in the world back in the early 1900s to write an article about what is wrong with the world. And they asked one author from Denmark, who was pretty famous at that time, his name is Chesterton. They asked him to write a letter. So he wrote the New York Times, and he said, in response to your question, what is wrong with the world, he wrote, I am. Signed his name and sent it back. I am. That's where we need to start. It takes courage to deal with me, to deal with my attitude, to deal with my disobedience, to deal with my life. That's where we need courage. And then we begin to face the other areas in our life every day. Courage is simply the desire, the fortitude to do the right thing every day. Not walk, well, I'll get to that someday. I'll come back. That's too big, or I don't have time. No, if it has to do with doing the right thing, we do it. And in the process of that, God is preparing us and continues to prepare us for what lies ahead, of which we do not know. The whole point of courage in the Christian life is we are not, as courage is displayed by Hollywood and their movies, going after the people who have hurt us. The whole theme of Hollywood is, I never forgive. I will get you, all right? The theme of Christianity is the opposite. It's I forgive. I refuse to hate. I refuse to carry this bitterness. So here is a man who is actually being killed and loves his enemies as he's dying. But are those not the words that Jesus said to us, to love your enemies, do good to those who hate you? This is courage like we have never needed it before to live our lives for Christ. So we can arrive at the end and have no regrets of having lived our lives the right way.